Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
1986, the number. Another summer.
Get down.
Sound of the funky drummer. In that fateful summer of 86, Hollydoor Records released a new anthology by the minister of heavy funk, James Brown. It was the latest in a long line of JB-related compilations that Polydor had been packaging together since the 1970s.
This one was different, though. It wasn't chronological. It wasn't a conventional greatest hits album. It was a greatest heat album. 9 songs of James Brown and the JBs at their funkiest.
What came first? Hip-hop producers mining the James Brown catalog, which spurred Polydor to hook this anthology up?
Or did this set off a gold rush to mine the James Brown catalog?
Either way, for the rest of the decade, producers the world over, armed with still primitive sampling technology, began to loop the breaks, beats, screams, and shouts off this album.
An entire mini generation of hip-hop heat rocks might not have existed without it, and for that reason, we begin a special 4-part heat rock series on samples with arguably the release that sparked the whole movement, James Brown's In the Jungle Groove.
Boogie jobbing rap is life where I'm from. Where I'm from, I might play with Izzy where I'm from. Where I'm from.
MC Ren, will you please give your testimony to the jury about this fucked up incident?
Fight the power! Fight the power!
Ain't it funky?
1, 2, 3, power!
The idea behind this series is that every quarter, Morgan and I will tape an episode of just her and I talking about key albums for both original samples as well as the albums that help make sampling into an art. Morgan, this was your brainchild, so why did you want to do a set of dedicated episodes about samples?
I think one to shine a light on artisan songs that birthed some of these other songs. I wanted to sort of shine a light on beat makers and DJs and their ingenuity and their creativity, and sort of to answer the question, musically speaking, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Were the songs that were sampled actually greater than the songs that sampled them? And I think we will decide this over the series, and I expect some pushback on that, but just keep us in prayer because we're going to go deep on this thing.
I know for me, I mean, obviously, samples are very close to my heart. I just want to make sure that when we tackle these things, it's to highlight both the relevance of sampling to modern music making and really recognize those artists whose contributions have shaped sampling, both as the source material, as we'll talk about today with James Brown and the JBs, but also on the other side of it in terms of the finished product.
Yep.
And to your point, Morgan, certainly talking about the key producers and beat makers who have, as I said earlier, turned sampling into an art form over the last 30 plus years.
Yep.
I don't know about you, but I feel like in order to kick this off, you kind of have to start with James Brown and In the Jungle Groove. And certainly sampling predates this album and artists were sampling from other folks besides JB. But when this album came out, if you look at the landscape of samples in 86, 87, 88, basically the whole rest of the 80s, you can trace dozens, if not hundreds of songs whose lineages all lead back to this one album. It was like Brown was everywhere in hip hop in the mid late 80s.
Yep. I mean, it's interesting that this album was recorded between 69 and 71 and didn't come out until 1986. But when I think about 1986 and the years that you're talking about, I can't remember one hip-hop song that I loved and danced to that didn't start with a sample or have a break in the middle that was sample heavy that was not James Brown. I just can't remember. And as we were, before the episode started, I was talking to Christian about sort of assuaging my guilt as a music supervisor for trying to chase these songs that have samples and then just being really pissed because we can't clear them. But more often than not, that sample is James Brown that we can't clear. It's expensive,
and
it's hard to trace, and then it puts it exposes the DJ that decided to sample this. And so it's like it's a moral thing. Do I put them on blast because they probably didn't clear it at the beginning? But to me, 1986 and this album reminds me of 9 minutes that changed everybody's lives. And that's the funky drum break that changed so many songs, changed the game. And I'm hoping that Clyde Stubblefield got his due.
Which I think, it's as we know, historically, he did not.
Yeah.
Because you can copyright certain things, you can certain things you can get writing credit for. publishing credit for. Drum breaks are not one of them.
No.
And this has been a big, big issue over the years, especially because so many key studio drummers were never able to get copyright clearance or a copyright credit on drum breaks because that's not considered to be unique enough artistically,
right.
Very different from melodies and harmonies, which can be. And as a result, a lot of these key drummers have never gotten paid for the, you know, thousands of samples that have been off.
Thousands. And it's worth mentioning that this album has been sampled over 1,500 times. And it's unfortunate that the drum break we're talking about has been referred to or been reduced to a drum break and not the drum break.
Right.
It is the drum break because it's the genesis of so many other things.
One thing that I think we should clear up, this album was, this was an anthology. So there was never like an original recording of it. It's the songs on here. Most of them were recorded at various sessions between, the earliest might have been as early as 69. I'm trying to remember when It's a New Day was taped, but certainly it captures a lot of the James Brown, Bootsy Collins era collaboration, which is only about, I think, a year total.
Yeah, because somebody got hot, right? Was it Bootsy that just got hot in the session and was like, I'm out?
I think it's more that James Brown lost a lot of musicians, and then they would come back, and then he would lose them again because he was a difficult man as a boss. But yeah,
to put it mildly.
Yeah, Bootsy had other, he certainly had, him and his brother, Catfish Collins, had other pastures to explore.
Indeed.
But in that year, you get a lot of the heat rocks that are on this particular album.
Indeed.
We should talk just a little bit about the history behind this particular compilation. Because up until this point, Polydor had already been putting out a series of James Brown-related anthologies throughout the entirety of the beginning of the early 80s, very popular ones. A lot of them were organized chronologically, so it would be James Brown, you know, 67 to 69, and then 70 to 72. In the Jungle Groove was different. It was not bound to a specific chronology, even though, to your point earlier, yes, it was using songs that were mostly recorded within a particular time frame, but it wasn't marketed that way. And what else made this different was it had previously unreleased songs, which we can get into later on. It had songs that were re-edited, Funky Drummer being the most obvious because they just isolate the break. But they also had, for example, the version of Give It Up or Turn It Loose, which originally appeared on the Sex Machine album, which was supposedly a live album, but if I recall, they actually overdubbed the crowd noise. And so what they did on the In the Jungle Groove version of it, they just took all of the crowd noise out and just isolated it to the song itself, which is not a version that had ever been presented before. There were some songs on here that had never been on an LP before. Funky Drummer, for example, was a 7-inch. It was never on a previous James Brown album. So this was very much, as we were joking, it's a greatest hit compilation that wasn't necessarily like number one hits, but it was designed around like what were him and the JB's best funky cuts from this era. And I reached out to one of the people who helped to compile this, Barry Feldman, who along with Cliff White, who worked in Polydor UK, they were two of the principal people behind this comp. And one of the things I asked him was, did you all put this out with the intention that you thought it might get sampled? And I didn't think that would be the answer because in 86, there just was not that much sampling happening. And more to the point, no one was paying for sampling.
No one was
paying. So if you were the label, why would you put it out in terms of like, yeah, please use our stuff, but don't clear it with us because you're not legally obligated? And what Barry wrote back to tell me, I'm going to paraphrase his response, but that was definitely not their intention. They had no idea that was going to happen. It was more that they'd been putting together these comps. Cliff White in the UK wanted to do something a little bit different, give it a little bit more of a curatorial focus by looking at these like hyper funk tracks from this era. Barry was like, that sounds great. Let's go ahead. This makes sense to me. And then they put it out like that. So it was really an accident of history that it became this singular source of so many important samples, especially in hip hop of that era. So now, were you messing with this album back in the 80s? When did you first discover it in the Jungle Groove?
Probably, I would say about 10 to 15 years ago. I'm not a huge James Brown devotee, and I say that knowing that the judgment will surely come. But I didn't, I was attracted to the hits of James Brown, so I didn't really go too deep. And then I got deeper into it around the time of Selma. I couldn't use it, yeah. Right. I couldn't use any of this stuff, unfortunately, but I started getting into it then. And then later on, when I was, we talked about voodoo on another episode, but I was sort of trying to trace the similarities between the production on D'Angelo's Voodoo and some of the songs on here. Mm. And we can talk a little bit about that later because it's close.
Yeah. I was going to spin back real quick, too. I think the part of the reason why it's very difficult to clear James Brown songs now is because when people were sampling this in the mid-late 80s, no one was clearing anything.
Nobody was clearing anything. It's the bane of my whole existence. It's like, come on. I get it. But as we were saying, unfortunately, some of the artists who people don't know won't know them because they weren't as famous as what was sampled from them. And James Brown and the drum break we're talking about is will go down as history, but it makes it so hard to clear that stuff.
Right. Well, we keep talking about this. Let's actually listen to it. And let's listen to the reprise version of Funky Drummer, which just isolates the drum track itself.
Ain't it funky?
I mean, damn. When I hear that, I immediately think about how many different places, not just how many different songs this is featured on, but how many places in songs. In hip-hop, it usually started. Someone would start talking over this drum break. Or it came in the middle to break down the song.
Right.
It's just famous. I mean, like I said, it's the 9 minutes that changed everyone's lives. The thing that comes to my mind immediately is Nas's Get Down.
For years now they chillin'. They had the coke game, something crazy. Sold music out the trunk of their car. That shit amazed me. Put me on the Heron blunts. Sherm or something. Took a puff. What the fuck?
To me, it just changed the tone of the song. It was unexpected the first time I heard it. It was unexpected last night. As I listened to it again, I was like, wow, this came weird. But again, to the point that I was saying that, either Funky Drummer started off a song or came in the middle to break and change the course of the song.
Right.
And that's a credit to this drum break. For however we want to reduce it, there's something about it that's so prolific that it's a game changer and it's a song changer. And that was one of my favorite uses
right.
of it.
I think a close second. If not, maybe even first would be the incredible Bongo Band's Apache Break, which Nas, of course, uses in Made You Look.
Now let's get it all in perspective for all y'all enjoyment, a song y'all can step with.
And I think it's because these samples have been used so many times. They have become signature moves in and of themselves. In other words, the deployment of it is not simply, this sounds good. It's, I'm showing you that I know my history.
Exactly.
By using the Funky Drummer.
Exactly.
By using Apache, right? Yep. Along those lines, one of my favorite uses of this song, which is not as prominent as the example that you use with Nas, but it comes from 1992 in Master Ace Incorporated's Boom Bashin' from the Slaughterhouse LP.
Doing a mind slick and quick. Up my sleeve is a trick. Hey, so what? I use Funky Drummer, suck my dick. I'm still thick with murderous beats.
And so, you know, by 92, you know, he was aware, yes, a lot of people have used it. Maybe people think it's played out, but fuck it. I'm going to use it anyways.
Right.
What are you going to do about it?
What are you going to do?
I just love the meta-ness of that, that he's just, he already anticipates the criticism and he's like, I don't care. Fuck you.
The swag in that, like whatever.
Right. The other example, one of my other favorite uses of a Funky Drummer, is also not from a hip-hop song. It's from George Michael's Waiting for That Day from the Freedom 90 album. And I have to say, just in terms of the engineering on this, they make this drum break so loud, so clean. This thing claps. And the thing is, when I first heard this song back in 1990, I did not know about the Funky Drummer. I mean, sampling was still relatively new to me at that age. But I knew, damn, that George Michael song sounds pretty funky. And it wasn't until years later I realized, oh, it's because he's using Funky Drummer. And I mean, it really speaks to both the ubiquity, not just of the sample, but of just sampling. By that point, hip hop had changed the game to the extent where pop artists, it doesn't matter what the genre was. I'm sure you could probably find country songs that would make stuff up, you know, but certainly pop artists, you know, George Michael and otherwise, were, you know, listening to what was happening with hip hop and incorporating a lot of those aesthetics into their own music. And I think Waiting for That Day's use of funky drummer is a great example of that. Let me ask this. What is it about the funky drummer, the drum break in particular, that you think is so memorable?
This is a lazy adjective.
It's funky?
I was going to rhyme with that. It's chunky. Mm. It's thick.
Mm.
There's just something about it that's so full in and of itself. That it's just so full and rich, even in its simplicity.
Right.
Every time I go to a show and they throw the drummer, it's like the drummer has been waiting for this moment all their life. And they hit you with a flurry of drum gymnastics. And at the end, you're like, damn, this isn't that. It's dope without being overly ambitious. And there's an echo to it that I just can't explain. And it's enough by itself. It had to be for it to have been used as many times as it's used in the many variations that it's used, and that it accomplishes a lot of things. It's a good closer. It's a good opening point. And it exists in a way that it can break up a song into a completely different place, like we saw with the Nas thing.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever those qualities are about this, to do it in something that's so simple,
yeah,
it is chunky. That's what I'll say. It's chunky.
For me, with Funky Drummer, it is different than I think a lot of other classic breakbeats from this era. So if you compare this, for example, against, let's say, the Skull Snaps beat. That's more straightforward.
Yep.
There's a lot of open space in the pocket with it. I mean, obviously that snare and the kicks are in your face, which is a big reason why people gravitated to it. But with Funky Drummer, it's the, to your point, it's the intricateness. It's the thickness. It's not just the thickness of the sound. It's all of the layers and textures of polyrhythm that are happening there. But to be honest, from a very practical level, the fact that the album simply isolated the drum track and turned it into a song itself,
right,
especially for people just learning to sample, you didn't have to pluck it out of the middle of the song. It was just right there done for you.
That's
and I think that's a big reason, too. They made it easy for people to mess with it in that sense.
Shame on them. Because now it's been sampled a gazillion times. But it also, to name a song Funky Drummer, lets you know that this thing gonna be funky, as James Brown loved to say.
Right.
When I think of famous drum breaks, usually I go to the Funky Drummer first, but a lot of people do Amen, Brother, the Winstons when they're talking about dance music as it being the start of techno and a lot of breakbeat stuff.
Right.
That's different. Not saying that it isn't as dope or it isn't as amazing, but when I think of classic, my number one would be Funky Drummer over Amen, Brother. You?
I'm the same way. I've never thought the Amen Brother break was that great as a break. I mean, it's not bad.
It's not terrible.
And if you understand the ways in which it became, I think, much more popular with really high tempo jungle and drum and bass
music, it
makes sense. But given the, you know, hip hop speed is, especially in the era that we're talking about of the 80s and 90s, that was, you know, around 100 BPM or slower.
Right.
Amen break is too fast for that. You would have to slow it down, but then that changes the character of it if you have to pitch it down that much. And so Funky Drummer doesn't have that problem because its tempo works well with what the pace of hip-hop was already at that point.
Right. I understand giving the credit to the Winstons and that drum break as the start of a genre, as
sure,
being behind the genre. And I'm not taking anything away from it.
Right.
I mean, I love dance music, so obviously I get it. But I think the Funky Drummer, that didn't give birth to a drama, but it certainly helped to carry a genre, which is because hip hop is drawn from it so much, it deserves to be credited to me as number one.
Yeah. We will be back in just a minute with more of our special sample discussion around James Brown's 1986 anthology, In the Jungle Groove. Keep it locked.
Hey everybody, this is J. Keith Van Stratton, host of Go Fact Yourself, a live game show here on the Maximum Fun Network. Make sure to listen to our next episode of Go Fact Yourself with guest Kurt Brownowler.
I did a show in Flagstaff, Arizona, where the venue just didn't list that the show existed.
Amazing.
And it is the smallest crowd that I've ever done a full hour of stand-up for. It was three people.
Oh my God.
And Sarah Schaefer.
Yes, I love crafting. It's my hobby. I have a craft nook in my home.
You do?
I do. It has all my supplies displayed in an adorable manner.
Wow.
Yes. Yes, applause.
Applause for a nook.
That's Go Fact Yourself here at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts.
Not all heroes wear capes. Some heroes watch war movies and then review them.
Friendly Fire is a war movie podcast for people who don't necessarily like war movies, although it does not exclude people who love war movies.
I'll have you know that I am wearing a cape. My cape is just made of sound-deadening material from an audio recording studio.
It's a really great show. John's daughter doesn't like it because we sometimes say swear words on it, but almost everybody else that has ever listened to it has enjoyed the program.
Download and subscribe to Friendly Fire wherever you get your podcasts.
To the victor, go the spoiler alerts.
And we are back on Heat Rocks with a special edition episode about sampling, and more specifically, James Brown's 1986 In the Jungle Groove.
So we both acknowledge that Funky Drummer, whether you're talking about the original full-length version of it or the reprise, which just isolates the drum track, that is obviously, I think, the centerpiece of the album in terms of how people have approached it sampling-wise. Is it to you, though, is it the fire track of the nine songs that are on here?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
It is the fire track. It's the fire track because of the other fire tracks that it reminds me of. I've mentioned Nas the Get Down. I didn't mention Public Enemy, Bring the Noise. Mm. And because that's one of my favorite Public Enemy tracks, and it will always be to me synonymous with this sample. That to me is the one that's the head nodder for me.
Never batter than bad, cause a brother is madder than mad at the fact that's corrupt like a senator. Soul on the road, but you treat it like soap on a rope, cause the beats and the lies are so dope.
Do you like the reprise where, again, just the isolated drum track, or do you actually like the full length version of Funky Drummer?
Both. I like the full length because it's a little bit more fleshed out. And how long can you just listen to drums before you're just like, well, this was cool,
well,
but can we move on? But it is funky and it is a head nodder, so I like both. But when I think of this album, I think of Funky Drummer first,
yeah,
before I think of anything else.
Yeah. I think when I first heard this album, it wasn't around 86. I think I probably would have discovered it more like, you know, 93, 94. But I might have known the drum break. I didn't know what the full actual song Funky Drummer sounded
sure.
like. And if you listen to it, especially at the beginning, it's not a song that sets you up with the expectation that that break's going to come. Like, it's so laid back.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool. It's jazzy.
Yeah, like you'd hear in a lounge.
Right.
Rat Pack.
And you would just never expect for this to drop in the way that it does.
Right.
It's in my shape. I walk the flow. I want to walk the flow. One, two, three, four. Get it. Good.
Yeah, you don't anticipate it.
No.
I mean, you know something's coming, because if you know enough about James Brown, the JBs, you know they're going to throw something in the bridge, but you're not expecting
that.
This.
No, especially based on the start of this song. You're like, okay, all right.
So my fire track is, without taking anything away from the importance and the influence and the excellence that is Funky Drummer, but this song to me is the embodiment of pure fire. And that is the cleaned up version, the crowd noise Liss version of Give It Up or Turn It Loose. And just from the very beginning, when the full band comes in, oh my God, it's so heavy.
Go!
Once again, Clyde Stubblefield on the drums.
Coming through.
Bootsy Collins on the bass. And that combination produces my single favorite moment on this album, which comes during the clap your hands, stomp your feet break, or bridge, which is about close to 5 minutes deep into this song. How come more people don't call out their bandmates to just drop in?
Because of beef. That's it. By the time they get to recording, stuff has gone down. They're like, I ain't calling you out. Whatever. Just play. That's my assessment of what's going on.
I still get chills because I know it's coming. And something about that bridge, I've never actually analyzed it in terms of how many bars in, because I feel like when he shouts out Clyde, it always surprises me. It catches me. I think it's going to come sooner or it's going to come later. But every time you just hear him shout that name out, and you know in that instant, that drum break is coming back.
You know.
And then 2 bars later. Come on. I mean, this bridge is just, oh my God, it's so amazing.
But what's the song on here where he starts out by saying, Ned, are we all right?
I think that might be the beginning of Talking Loud and Saying Nothing.
How's that sound, Ron? Okay. One, two, three, hit it.
That's my favorite moment on the album for the same reasons, because it's very... you know, it's unpolished. And I don't know who Ron is. Who is Ron?
we gotta scrub through the credits to figure that out. But yeah.
That's one of my favorite moments where he's like, are we okay, Ron? And then he just starts out and it just dissolves into funkiness from the boot. So shout out to the conversation between James Brown and his players. For what we have been saying heretofore, James was a difficult person to work for, but obviously he had some sort of rapport with his session musicians because they had a good conversation.
To bring this back to Give It Up or Turn It Loose, I just want to highlight a few of my favorite samples. I'm going to start with one that it's really obscure. In fact, I don't assume that most of our listeners would have ever heard this before, because it's a random rap, fast rap single from 1991 from New Jersey that was never a national hit. But it's by a group called Keek and KG, and it's a song called Don't Say It, Sing It. And really all it is just the drum break from that James Brown song. Give me your rhythm, all clap and don't lack back. The team bit well, never knew I had. Check the line, if the rhyme's a crime, then scoop me. Put me back in the old hoop. We're going to win it this time and excel with every episode. Let me correct myself. I said it was only the drum break. It's the drum break with the Bootsy Collins bass line. But that's all it really is. It's just that part of the song. And they really juice it up. And it sounds amazing. I want to give an honorary mention to Gangstar's Got You, which is not one of my favorite Gangstar songs. It's from their very first LP, No More Mr. Nice Guy. But what I like about it is that on this song, they clearly are using not just Give It Up or Turn It Loose, but they're also using the guitar from another song off of In the Jungle Groove, which is Get Up, Get Into It, Get Involved. And it just shows you the ways in which rap artists of this era were mining this album so, so heavy.
Yep.
Combining some from equations or phrases, because I've begun some exploratory digging. I'm thinking big and I'm digging all your words, because just
I just learned. Not probably the most prolific use of the sample, but I'm going to say it. And again, I'm coming into this episode knowing that there will be blowback. But Cece Peniston and a song that made her famous called Finally. Not life changing, but it changed me. Again, not life-changing and surprising, and I think this remix was Armand Van Helden, but again, James Brown on this album did not, and the samples on this album were not exclusively hip-hop samples. They were also dance music samples. Get Up, Get Into It, Get Involved is one of my favorite jams on this album, and probably one of my favorite uses of this was Full Force and their song Ain't My Type of Hype.
Full Force.
You really like New Jack Swing a lot better than I did. Real talk.
I knew this day would come. I do like New Jack Swing.
You do.
Full Force, of course. What a band. Had some of the best curls. Jerry curls that I knew, with the exception of my cousin Kelly. Kelly had a California curl. But that album, Smooth, one of my favorites. Ain't My Type of Hype. And, of course, they sampled Get Up, Get Into It, Get Involved.
Morgan, I'm glad you brought up, Get Into It, and Get Involved, because every time I listen to this song, what really comes to mind is how it is one of the most, to me, terrifying songs in the James Brown catalog. And I think part of it is, the rhythm is obviously really, really aggressive. It's driving, but it's the guitar work. And I don't know, there's two credited guitarists. There's Catfish Collins, who was Bootsy Collins' brother, and then Herlin Martin. And I don't know if one or both of them are playing on here, but it is so dissonant. It screeches in a particular way. I can't imagine when this, and I believe this was another one of those single-only songs, and it only came out on a 45 back in its original release, I think, in 1970. But it's hard for me to listen to this and not think about the context of, let's say, the Vietnam War, and thinking, and I'm spinning back to something that Vernon Reed had said during our Heat Rocks episode about Jimi Hendrix and Band of Gypsies and the song Machine Gun, where Hendrix wanted the song to sound like war. And something about Get Up, Get Into It, Get Involved, it has that same kind of controlled chaos to it. And it is very much, I think, unlike a lot of the other songs on the same album, even though the personnel is the same, and yes, it's all really funky, but the edge that that electric guitar lends on it, to me, there is just something completely terrifying. And I just kind of imagine if you were a conservative white Southerner in 1970, like Jim Crow's on its way out, like you got Black Power on the surge, and this comes out, like this must be like the sound of your nightmare.
This is the racial apocalypse. And James Brown is screaming at the top of this track, get up, get involved. It's got to be.
Get on up.
Do you have a slow burner off of this album?
I'm only going to call it a slow burner because we haven't talked about it. And that's Hot Pants.
Oh, that's where it's at. That's where it's at. Hot Pants. Smoking.
This is my favorite track on here vocally for James Brown.
Oh, interesting.
To me, he sings more on here than anything else. It's obviously not the longest song, but it's the second longest song on here, and it's the one that I get a chance to hear him sing. Mm. Because although you could probably break this album down to three things, horns, drums, and grunts, I love James Brown's voice, and I love his vocals on Hot Pants. So that for me would be the slow burner and the sleeper, because we're so focused on the instrumentation and the drum breaks that I think this one gets lost in the shuffle.
For me, the slow burner would be, and partly it's because it's, I think, the one fully unreleased song, in other words, had never come out in any format, which is I Got to Move. And it's a long, another long one. I think this is like another 8-9 minute song. But there's a breakdown that comes about 4 minutes in that is just perfection.
Take me to the water.
Number one, anytime James Brown warns you that he's about to take you to the bridge or he wants to walk it out, like, don't go anywhere. crank that volume knob to 11 and just wait for it, because something good is about to happen. I Got to Move is certainly no exception to that. And, you know, partly why I also wanted to pluck this one out is because when we talk about digging in the crates, which is a term that, of course, back in the 90s was about looking through old records to find samples, right? That phrase was introduced, I think, to most of us, if not all of us, through Showbiz and AG featuring Diamond D's song, Digging in the Crates, which came out on the Party Groove Soul Clap EP from, I think, 91 or at latest 92. I think it was 91. And they build a lot of that song off of that specific breakdown on I Got to Move. So Digging in the Crates as a phrase owes part of its existence to James Brown in the Jungle Groove, as we've been talking about.
It's also sampled by Cypress Hill on How I Could Just Kill a Man, the Blunted remix, and it shows up at the 205 mark. One of the strangest drop-ins, because he's talking about killing a man, and then James Brown is like, clap your hands, stomp your feet, and it's like, a bit off-brand, but okay.
So, Morgan, this is the first of our, what will be four installments for this year around sampling. We haven't actually picked what's going to come next. I know we want to pick at least one other album that was important as a sample source, but we got to get into the albums that, you know, really helped to shape the art of sampling. And without, you know, committing either of us, what do you think, what comes to mind that you think we could get into?
My first thing, but we've already covered this, is we cannot talk about sampling at all without stopping by Funkadelic. And what comes to me first to mind is The Chronic, but we've already talked about it. So right. I don't know what album we have to do next, but we have to consider Funkadelic. Mm. Parliament Funkadelic.
Well, I would think in terms of the albums that have used sampling in really important ways, kind of feel like we got to talk about Pete Rock and CL Smooth and Mech and the Soul Brother. You know, we could get into Tribe. We did De La's 3 Feet High and Rising. That would have been a really good example to get into this conversation. I agree with you about P-Funk, though, as I said on that episode with Mayor Hawthorne, like, I'm kind of over P-Funk in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, I respect that. It'd be interesting to maybe get into some of the key jazz albums, whether it was sort of Blue Note albums that got used a lot, get into CTI, for example. Mm-hmm. So that would be kind of another avenue to go down. You know, listeners, if you have your suggestions after you hear this air, we're gonna space these out quarterly. So it's not going to be back to back to back, but we're going to try to roll out new episodes for the series every couple of months. So if you have suggestions for us that you think of either, again, sample source albums or albums that use samples in important ways, you know, drop us a line on our socials and let us know. And we'll swim through that batch and see what jumps out to us.
Even if there are some obscure samples that you think we haven't mentioned yet, that you've discovered in your own musical journey, things that you think deserve some notice, things that you think deserve some discussion, please let us know about those things, because we'll go deep with them.
The funky drama. The funky drama.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wong, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess, one of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne.
We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles.
Good to see you again, Oliver.
Good to see you too, Morgan. One last thing. Here's a teaser for next week's episode, which features singer and songwriter Bea Beeman talking to us about Sly and the Family Stone's Stand.
Something that was impactful to me, and their politics and their music and everything, but even if you just look at them as a band.
Right.
Yeah.
White, black, Latin, in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I mean, Santana kind of had a similar type of amalgam of things, but he didn't sing political things like Sly did. And just looking at them was different. And that was a statement like, oh, this guy's inclusive,
right?
Right off the bat, like, or this band is inclusive, this music is inclusive. So that was an appeal to me, just on a very surface level.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.